On Sunday, September 21st at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents a Memorial Joe Sample broadcast. Join us as we remember his career with and without the Crusaders, the music industry in general, and many other things, including his Creole Joe project. That's Sunday, September 21st at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
So sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl.
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. And tonight we are presenting a memorial broadcast for the late Joe Sample, member of the Crusaders and session player and Creole Joe. You'll find out more about that if you stay tuned. We do send our condolences to the Sample family, his life partner Yolanda, and his son Nicholas, and any other members that I am not aware of. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl, coming up now.
Things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I am on the phone with...
Joe Sample.
Joe Sample, thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
It's my pleasure to be here with you. Thank you.
And I've just enjoyed your music over the years, varying forms of your music at that. So thank you so much.
Glory, thank you. Thank you.
You were born in Houston, Texas, which is where you are now, huh?
Yes. In 58, after 3 years of being a music major at Texas Southern University, which is a black university, I decided it was time to move somewhere where the big musicians live. That was either New York City or Los Angeles. So the Crusaders, my buddies, we decided to make a move out to Los Angeles in 1958. And we began recording in 1961. So I then returned to Houston. I gave up my California driver's license in 99, and I became an official resident of the state of Texas at that time. I got a Texas driver's license for the second time in my life. When I left here in 1958, it was actually June 6th of 1958, which was D-Day in 1944. So when I got out of Texas, and we had a hassle with a racist mechanic right at the Texas-New Mexico state line.
Hmm.
I vowed then, at that time, I would never, ever set foot ever in my life again south of the Mason and Dixon line. Well, of course, I came back for funerals. Everybody was dying. All of my older relatives were dying in the night, and the last of them died in the early 1970s. I would come through Houston simply to do shows. Also, at that time I left here, I believed that I would never, ever see the end of segregation in my lifetime.
Mm.
It was so intense when I lived here. The hate was so extreme, I believed that I would never see the end of it. I just finished looking at MSNBC, and Al Sharpton happens to be one of my favorite shows. And Chris Matthews came on, and they were commenting how these right-wing politicians are just in a full-on hate campaign against Obama and his wife now.
Right.
So, yes, it does remind me of the old days in the South. And what I see, there's still some of the old school that are still alive. Now, I used to go to the parade in downtown Houston on Memorial Day. And this was the 40s and the early 50s. And they had the last surviving Texas Civil War Confederate soldier. It was an old guy sitting in the back of an open automobile. And he had his Confederate suit on, and he had a rifle alongside him. And they were propping this guy up. He had to have been 100 years old. And I knew that segregation would remain. It was never a possible chance for segregation to end until this old, only Confederate soldier would finally die.
Wow.
But the remnants of that, I still feel they are still fighting the Civil War.
How did you wind up coming back to Houston? What was the thing that made you want to come back?
Well, first of all, the music industry vanished. It just is gone. By 1982, what is it? The FCC had given the right that any radio station owner at that time, around 82, could now own as many radio stations as the owner desired to own.
Right.
Consequently, we got into the mega radio circuit. So all of the smaller stations, all of those stations that were playing jazz, that were playing wonderful music, was gobbled up. Most of them turned into talk radio. And then the music companies, the corporations moved in on the music labels. There used to be 300 independent record labels. By 1982, they were all gone.
Right.
Everything became the property of six corporate structures. And Motown was one of the last ones to survive, but Barry Gordy even sold out in around 87. And what everyone had in mind was that they wanted to hear on radio exactly the same thing in Maine that was being played in San Diego.
Right.
So what it started doing was killing that powerful regionalism that we had here. We had New Orleans, Houston, Dallas, Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, Pittsburgh. Every last one of those areas had that particular style of music, and that is what made America so rich and wonderful in the music. That was the Bay Area. That was Los Angeles. That was Seattle.
Right.
Every area had its own particular style. Well, when the corporate world came in, they killed all of that. They wanted everybody to hear the same thing on the radio at the same time, eventually. And then there's MTV now. The moment I saw the first video, I knew that the younger people would not hear or feel music. They were going to begin to eyeball music.
Mm.
And that's exactly what happened. I would ask your youngsters, so why do you like that? And they would say, I don't know if I like it yet. I haven't seen the video.
Exactly.
So they had nothing to do with music anymore. And in Los Angeles, Southern California became a city of celebrity. It's all celebrity. And the other night, I'm sitting here with these ladies, and they had just watched one of the vocal contest shows that my wife started, like, dialing this number to vote.
Uh-huh.
And she kept calling and calling, and I finally asked her, well, who are you voting for? How many people are you voting for? And she said, oh, I am voting for one singer. I said, well, how many times are you doing it? She said, as many times as I can. So I said, you've got to be kidding me. You can just keep voting and voting and voting.
Right.
You just don't get one vote. So I said, oh, even this is rigged. Industry, as I knew it once, has vanished today. It isn't the same thing. I speak to all of my old friends in the music game. And we know that music business we knew and we grew up with and we matured in and we've worked ourselves into is now gone. So when I record now, when I write now, when I do anything, it's only based upon my desire. It has to be personal, which I want to do solo piano records. I want to write songs for those singers who will sing my songs.
Right.
But there's no business anymore as it was. We used to release an album, and the record company would ship 50,000 records, and they would just be gobbled up in 2 weeks. And then they would ship another 50,000,
right.
Get all the way up to 500,000 records, which was gold. Or you may sell 250,000, 350,000. You know what? A lot of people made an excellent living with sales of that nature.
Sure.
Now, they only have a few people selling Mega Million records.
Yeah, distribution is very different these days.
San Francisco morning coming clear and cold. Don't know if I'm waking or I'm dreaming. With Fats Waller on the Super G. He said music's real, the rest is
I know we've actually fast-forwarded, and I'm glad because I really wanted to hear your view about the industry these days. How is your music distributed these days?
Well, now, I am not signed to a record label. I am doing business with my manager, Patrick Range. He has a record company called PRA.
Mm-hmm.
I have a record I recorded with the indie or big band of Hamburg, Germany, and it is titled Children of the Sun. Now, it was released in Germany, and this fall, I did a 17-city tour with the NDR big band. I did Children of the Sun, which has to do with slavery. And then Al Jarreau came out, and he did selections from Porgy and Bess. And we had a wonderful tour.
Excellent.
Now, the album was released in Germany, and I think it may have been released also in Japan. Hmm. It will be released here, but there has to be some sort of tour schedule. I have to feature the music live. We just don't release records anymore. It has to be supported by touring, which records are always had to be supported by touring. And the record companies used to call it tour support.
So is that something that's not happening as frequently? That, you know.
No, when MCA bought ABC Records in 1980, the first thing I learned was they had discontinued tour support. Mm. They were killing the industry right away. They were not going to support. And then eventually I was at Warner Brothers, 89, 90, and by the mid-90s, Warner Brothers, they had fired all of the legendary music businessmen of Warner Brothers Records. You know, the guys who had created the label, who had created so many styles of music, who had supported all of the wonderful music that came on the Warner Brothers label. They got rid of all those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, I was still signed to Warner Brothers. My contract was up, and I left. And then I heard that one of the corporate guys went to the jazz people, left there still, and asked him, why do you sign these people that you call artists? Why do you sign people like that who are only going to sell 40, 50,000 records? Why do you sign people like that? So that was the mentality of the corporate world. Well, in ABC days, in the 1970s, we were going up to 400,000 to 500,000 to gold records. And some of them even went platinum, which was a million. Well, these people don't even know that those records used to sell in those amounts. But because of the loss of the airplay and the non-interest in the corporate power, in other words, the new record people are not music people. They are marketing people.
Right.
And when I met the first guys at MCA, and I went up there, I went to the Black Tower probably in 81, and I started meeting this new record company who owned my contracts. Also the Crusaders, I went in there, and I looked at these people, and I felt like I was in a bank. I felt like I was in an insurance company.
Sure.
And I started asking my manager, who are these people? And then I began to understand they were coming out of Harvard Business School.
Right.
Yale School. They didn't know anything about music.
Right. They just knew about the bottom line.
Exactly.
Wow. So that pretty much brought you back to Houston, where I guess you do what you want in Houston.
Well, and L.A., man, the younger people got rude in L.A. Mm. You know, just driving down the street, all the old rules and that we followed, when, you know, we were driving. Now, all of a sudden, in 1990, you just got a bunch of wild, mean, angry, rude young people on the streets.
Mm.
And I just decided I don't want to live like this. I thought about moving a lot of places, New Orleans to southern France. I was offered a professorship at a university at Cologne, Germany.
Wow.
I wanted to move to the Tuscany region. I wanted to move somewhere where people still hang on to their roots. The Italians still love opera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you bring a taxi cab there, and the cab driver is singing along with the opera singers.
Right.
Know? And here we are, I'm out in California, man, nobody even knows what music is anymore.
Mm.
I thought about New Orleans, and that is my mother's home, and my grandmother's home, and then I said, no, you know what, I'm going back to my home, and right away I became involved with raising funds for the Black Catholic School.
Huh.
And I am supporting three of them now, and I will do an annual concert in Galveston, and I will have guests come in, like Randy Crawford, has been in L.A. like that. Hathaway has come.
Wow.
A year ago, I gave the three black Catholic schools at least $20,000 each, a total of $60,000.
Beautiful.
And I am preparing for the next show, September the 28th.
Oh.
Black Catholic schools have really been failing. Well, I'm from the Fifth Ward. They have shut my old school down.
Mm.
My parents were founders of that Catholic church in 1928.
Wow.
After the great flood of the Mississippi River. 800,000 people had to get out of Louisiana. A lot of them, including my family, came over from western Louisiana into southeast Texas. My parents were founders. I called it the Creole School. It looked like everybody was mixed. Most of the people were the mixed people of Louisiana. And they were Catholic. We were all Catholics. I had a nun educated. I didn't go to public school until the ninth grade. I am now an artist in residence at Texas Southern University, which is my old black university. So I'm over there now working with very talented youth. We have a performance that is coming up. It will be at the local bar, and I will present the Joe Sample Jazz Orchestra.
Wow.
We will be playing the music that I wrote for the NDR Big Band, which is titled Children of the Sun. We're going to have a smaller group, a combo, six musicians, who will play the music of the Jazz Crusaders and the Crusaders. And then at the Galveston show, the Crusaders will actually perform with the big band, and then we will then feature a local singer who I grew up with here. Her name is Jewel Brown.
Okay.
So she's going to sing Street Life, Soul Shadows, or two of my songs, and then we're going to, every day I've got the blues, and we're going to do this all with the Joe Sample Jazz Orchestra.
Wonderful.
And this is at the Galveston Opera House. I'm having a wonderful time here writing and working with the youngsters.
I understand music for you growing up was Zydeco and Louis Armstrong. Is that true?
Well, in the 1940s, the term Zydeco had not been created yet. That didn't come along until the 70s.
Right.
And that Creole music that I heard, in fact, the very first musician that I heard live playing at my black Catholic church, Our Mother of Mercy, was Clifton Chenier.
Tell them all my
And this was around 1947. And Clifton Chenier played a dance at least twice a month in the auditorium of the school there, All Mother of Mercy School, which at that time, it went from the first to the 12th grade. They did not call the music Dodico then. It was known as La La. My parents would tell me, my brother, and my sister, kids, they'll be good. Your uncle is going to take care of you. Your father and I are going to the La La dance to hear the La La band play the La La music. <It's called> La La. So, and I, now today I have the Joe Sample, no, the Creole Joe band.
Oh, nice.
We're going to perform in New York at the Blue Note.
Really?
Yes.
When?
September the 10th or 12th or something like that.
Oh,
the
my goodness.
The band is coming to the Blue Note in New York. Guess what I'm playing?
What are you playing?
Accordion.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How long have you been playing the accordion?
Well, this record called the Creole Joe Band, I started when I moved back here. When I started coming back here, it was in 97. The Zydeco musicians had changed the music up, and what they had stopped doing was playing blues. The La La music was filled with blues. This was black southern music.
Right.
And now the younger guys don't know anything about the blues anymore. So I started writing blues. I started writing old Creole melodies, the things that I remembered in my community in the 1940s, which I was born in 1939, and I heard Clifton Chenier for the first time in 1947, and I heard the Cajun music. I grew up with all that. It's a part of my DNA.
Right.
So when I came back here, I said, man, what did y'all do to the music? I just started writing these melodies. These melodies would just come out of me.
Wow.
And my wife's sister began putting stories to them. This is the most difficult project I've ever had to do. The record was completed maybe 2 years ago. It was released in Japan. We performed in Japan a year ago. It took me 13, 14 years to get that record finalized. It was nothing but problems.
Oh, my. What kind of problems were there?
Well, just trying to get musicians to feel the music. This is, I'm an old dinosaur. I'm back. And said, no, man, you can't play it like that. You gotta play it like this. Ray Parker Jr. came in. He felt all of the rhythms.
Uh-huh.
A drummer from New Orleans came in. My son, the bass player, came in. And he listened to it, and eventually he understood what the feeling should be with the bass. And CJ's son, of course, I'm playing accordion on it, and some singers from New Orleans stepped into it. It's a very unique band, a very unique style of music also.
Now, you never actually mentioned how you wound up playing accordion. Did you teach yourself, or what happened there?
Well, I knew that nobody was going to be able to write all this music. I'm getting ready to make this record, and I'm looking around. And I said, man, they don't even play the keyboard accordions anymore.
Oh.
They can't. They only play the button accordions. The button accordions are like the harmonica. So you are pigeonholed. You can't have a verse in C and the bridge goes to E. You can't do that on the button accordions. The only way you can do that is to play the keyboard accordion. There's very few of those players. And to get guys to feel what I'm feeling, I knew I was going to have to do a lot of this work myself.
Wow. Wow.
So 5 years ago, I bought one. I'm looking at August where I'm going to have to do some serious practicing.
So in September, is that when we'll all get a chance to hear some of this? I mean, of course, we'll hear you at the Blue Note. Is that when a recording is going to be released?
I would imagine it would be, because we would love to sell them there.
That would be great.
And we would love to spread the word. We're going to be at the Blue Note in Annapolis, Alexandria, Virginia, and somewhere at a festival in Georgia.
Oh, when does it start? When do you start the tour?
We may do an opening date here in Houston, in an area known as the Woodlands. There's a club up there that books all kinds of acts. It is called the Do-Si-Do. That would be a good place to start off. I would love to be able to do a live gig, you know, a rehearsal, and then a live gig. And then the next day, we all travel to New York.
Okay, so it's going to be in September when you kick it off.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Wonderful. Now let's go back. I keep wanting to go back, but there's so much happening in the present. So we wind up talking about what you're doing now, and that's so wonderful that you're still working. We love that. We love that you're still doing stuff.
Oh, yeah. I'm having fun. I'm always doing.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. And you're listening to a Joe Sample Memorial Broadcast. And what you're listening to right now is Put It Where You Want It, The Crusaders. This is from a compilation, The Very Best of The Crusaders. This compilation is a 2003 Blue Thumb Records release, but it was originally released in 1972 on Blue Thumb. Before that, we heard Creole Joe. This is Joe Sample and his Creole Joe Band project. The name of the group is the Creole Joe Band. It's a 2013 PRA Records, P-R-A Records release. Before that, we heard Rosemary from Clifton Chenier. The Creole Joe Band features Ray Parker Jr. and C.J. Chenier, who is actually the son of Clifton Chenier. Clifton Chenier, Rosemary, is from the Clifton Sings the Blues release. This is a 2004 reissue Arhuli Records. It was originally recorded in 1993, it says. Arhuli, A-R-H-O-O-L-I-E. Before that, we heard Soul Shadows, the title cut of Bill Withers and the Crusaders. Before that, we heard Carmel from Joe Sample, the title track, a GRP Records 1979 release. Before that, we heard Rule Renewal. That was the Crusaders featuring Eric Clapton on guitar. It was a 2003 PRA Records Verve release. Before that, we heard Fool's Gold, Joe Sample featuring Liz Wright on vocals. The Pecan Tree, or Pecan Tree, PRA Verve Records. It was originally released in 2002. Before that, we heard Adventures in Paradise, Minnie Riperton. Joe Sample co-wrote the song with Robert Rudolph and Minnie Riperton is from a 1975 Capitol Records release. Before that, we heard our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, Nina Simone, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967, 1972, RCA BMG release. It was originally recorded in 1967. Stay tuned for more conversation with the recently departed Joe Sample. Joe Sample left this plane on Friday, September 12th. Stay tuned for a discussion that we had with him in 2013 when he was preparing to open with the Creole Joe Band at the Blue Note. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for September 21st. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's show is a memorial to the late Joe Sample, but there are other opportunities to see Sugar guests in action. Saxophonist Billy Harper will be appearing at the Blue Note on September 23rd and 24th with the Cookers. Also at the Blue Note is saxophonist Lou Donaldson, who leads a quartet for one night only on September 25th. See BlueNote.net for details on all of those shows. That's BlueNote.net. Bassist Christian McBride will be out on Long Island at the Sag Harbor Music Festival on September 26th. Go to sagharbormusic.org. for details. And you have two chances to see drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria this week. He'll be at Kitana with Antoinette Montague on the 26th, and his monthly gigs leading the New School University Student Afro-Cuban Jazz Band at the Nuyorican Poets Cafe starts on the 28th. Look for them the last Sunday of the month for the rest of the school year. Go to kitano.com for information on the show on the 26th and Nuyorican.org for the 28th. Again, that's kitano.com and nuyorican.org. September 27th looks to be a big day music-wise. You can catch organist John Medeski at the Town Hall Theater in Strange and Beautiful. Info is at thetownhall.org. That's thetownhall.org. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts will be at Les Poissons Rouges with the Paul Bolenbeck Trio. Go to lpr.com for details on this show. That's lpr.com. And you can see drummer J.T. Lewis in action at the Harlem Stage Gatehouse on the City College of New York campus with the Harriet Tubman Band and singer Cassandra Wilson in a Henry Threadgill tribute. Go to harlemstage.org for details. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the MADE website as well. WBAI Radio still needs your help. If you like what we do, help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. Click the Support WBAI link on our site to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off. We're off the WBAI airwaves next week for the last Sunday of the month, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, October 5th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
So your schoolmates, the Jazz Crusaders.
Right. Well, eventually I got to high school here, Wheatley High School, and it was there, I believe, in the 10th grade, that our principal came over this PA system and said that there was an historical ruling that the Supreme Court had just made. It must have been 1954, the Supreme Court decision on the question of separate but equal. I thought that the next day I would be sitting in class with white kids.
Hmm.
But it wasn't like that.
Right.
So the school I was in, though, the Texans were very wise, and they knew, or they had a strong feeling, that the courts were going to rule in favor of the Negro.
Mm-hmm.
So they felt like as long as the schools were equal, that segregation is okay. And what I am leading to is this Wheatley High School that I went to was a state-of-the-art school. That's where I met the Crusaders, all of them. I had known Wayne since I was 6 years old.
That's Wayne Henderson.
Wilson Felder lived around the corner from me. Finally, in the 10th grade, I got to Wheatley, and right away, all of us were inducted into the jazz orchestra. I played piano. There was sticks playing the drums, Wayne Henderson, Wilson Felder. And Hubert Laws was there also.
Right.
And our bass player was a guy by the name of Henry Wilson, Lala we called him. During that high school time, we formed a group just because we just loved playing with each other so much. We formed a group called the Modern Jazz Sextet. We were drawn together by all the musicality was appealing. Each one of us appealed to all of the other guys. And besides that, I played a clarinet in the marching band, and we were all at the football games marching on the football field. And so we decided in 1958 to leave Houston because I felt like there was no future there. I wanted to be where the great musicians were. That was either in Los Angeles or New York. And we all chose California because we did have family, there, relatives there. And that's why we went there. And soon after that, we became one of the hottest dance bands in Southern California. And Wilton ended up playing, we all ended up the various times being a part of the Johnny Guitar Watson band at the 5-4 Ballroom.
Okay.
Yeah, Johnny Guitar Watson was another Houstonian.
Okay.
And he heard of this young Texas band that had come out there. And let me tell you, it ain't easy finding a musician, no matter what he plays, who can groove, who knows how to groove, how to swing, how to make music feel good, and also sound good, or get off a bandstand and get people excited. They don't have enough musicians like that.
You mean presently or at that time?
I mean, any time. Right now, it's the same problem. No.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I hear you guys today, all I hear are loud, loud, loud musicians.
Mm.
Loud bands, loud amplifiers, loud speakers. The drummers have got bigger drums. The drumsticks are bigger. The cymbals have no sensitivity to them. They're just loud.
Wow.
They are so loud. I just hear a roar. I do not hear or feel the ping, 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 ping.
Right.
I don't hear that. I just hear rah, a roar. So when I go out to hear the other bands play, they see me coming. They know I'm going to tell them that they are too damn loud.
Gosh. So fortunately, the group back in the day, pre-Crusaders, I guess, what was forming to become the Crusaders, you guys knew how to swing.
Well, we were always looking for a contract, a recording contract. I knew we were not ready for it when we went out there. And I felt that as time went on, by 1960 and 61, we were in Las Vegas working as a show band, and we had an act. We called ourselves the Hollywood Nighthawks. That was a vocal group known as the Titans, and there was a female singer whose name is Mickey Nin. So we were dynamic in the bar areas of a casino in Las Vegas. We were at the New Frontier. Our responsibility was, as soon as the main showroom was over and the audience was filing out, our responsibility was to grab their attention and hit them with this music and make them come in there and sit down at the bar. Eventually, they then would gamble.
Okay.
And that was the concept. But we were a lounge act. Well, I hate it.
Yeah.
And eventually, we got an offer in 1961 to come to a Pacific Jazz recording studios. The owner was Richard Bach, a recording audition. You go in, you set up, and you perform. And Anna Dill was side A on a Monday. In 3 hours, you got two takes a song. Took Tuesdays off. You came back Wednesday to record side B.
Wow.
The same thing. Two takes of the song. Well, halfway through the first day, we had recorded three songs, and Richard Bach came into the recording room, and he said, "Fellas, relax. You are now recording artists."
Oh.
And we didn't have a name yet. And one of the girlfriends said that you guys have always crusaded for jazz, so why don't you call yourselves the Jazz Crusaders? And that's what we did. And that was the beginning. And that record, I wrote the title track, The Freedom Sound.
Yes.
The Freedom Sound became a single, and it ended up in the U.S. Top 40 charts. And it positioned at number 17.
song just sounded like freedom. I mean, it was, what was, I don't know if you remember your feeling when you were writing it, but what was your motivation for that? I mean, it sounded like, you know, the civil rights movement.
Well, it was, of course, in the civil rights movement, and I had just said, I was never ever going to go back down south of the Mason and Dixon line.
Right.
And Art Blakely had done a piece, something about freedom dance or this.
Right.
So I decided to write this. I was afraid to play it for the band because I didn't think they would like it. And, and it was a march. You had a bass line. It was moving, mm-hmm. and it kept marching. We still play it today.
Oh, I love that song.
And it's a unique melody. We had something with us. Eventually, every record that we did, the majority of them went straight to the top of the jazz charts.
Right.
I noticed in 63, by beginning hearing of avant-garde jazz, of free jazz, in 68, I knew it seemed as if the free jazz, avant-garde jazz, had come to the forefront. Me personally, I made two decisions. One was in Cleveland sometime in 68, I told the Jazz Crusaders that I could not continue to live this life I was living as a jazz musician, because every single piano I encountered, they were horrible.
Mm.
And I told them, I feel like this is a waste of my life. Me coming out here and running into, I called them, dog du jour. And in Cleveland, the piano, there were only three notes on the piano that sounded. The keys didn't play.
Oh, no.
And they were horrible, horrible. Most of these promoters, most of these owners of these jazz clubs, they were suspicious. They were not in this because they loved music, and, mm-hmm. and they didn't give a damn about the musicians, and they didn't give a damn about me having a good piano. I still have that problem today.
Wow.
The piano that I love, the Hamburg Steinway, is probably $150,000. So where am I going to find that piano? I still have problems today with pianos. So in 68, I told them I was staying in Los Angeles and I was going to figure out, or I was going to spend my time now. I had a reputation now, and I was going to take my reputation and work myself into the studio scene of Los Angeles. And that's what happened. Eventually, I was a studio musician for 15 years. Well, 15 years of being a studio musician, and then I described to you how the end of the music business began.
Right.
MTV, the loss of the record labels, the corporate world coming in and getting rid of all of the record labels. But in 68, also, I heard of the electric piano. Now, that was not only was it the acoustic piano, I had to make a decision if I was going to suddenly turn from all of the work, the things that I was passionate about music, which I started developing in 1940, when I heard Duke Ellington and the Count Basie band and this and all the big bands and all the blues. Now all of a sudden, in 1968, everything has gone to free jazz. Mm-hmm. I had to make a decision. I'm not going to free jazz. All the black guys were changing their names to African names.
Right.
You know, Muhammad Ali did that, and he got everybody went into Islamic names and mm-hmm. that, and guys started wearing dashikis.
Right.
I said, no, man. I'm a Southern black man. I know who I am. I don't give a damn what the guys in New York or anywhere else in the world are doing. I know what I love about music, and I will continue to make myself better at doing that. And then, we being from Southeast Texas, we always had that instinct for the gospel and the blues to be portrayed in our music also.
Right.
It was naturally there. It
right.
was a part of my upbringing. And I feel like when I was born, I got a number of gifts from the Lord.
Sure.
He made sure that I understood every ingredient of African-American music, American music. I had a passion and love to learn European music. And he made sure I was a music lover.
Well, I understand the reason why you dropped the jazz in the Jazz Crusade, or why that was dropped, was that it opened you up to not be pigeonholed to just being jazz artists.
One of the biggest things was the Japanese government barred all black jazz bands from getting a visa to Japan.
What?
Why? They were dealing with drugs. And Art Blakey's band was one of the worst ones, the Jazz Messengers.
Oh.
So we knew we would never go to Japan if we were called the Jazz Crusaders.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm not going to let that word jazz hold me back. If that's what, you know, the reality was, these jazz musicians were going around the world and fucking up. Jazz musicians were going around the world screwing up.
Right.
So I said, no, man, let's just be the Crusaders.
Uh-huh.
But more so than that, I didn't like where jazz was going.
Because of the free avant-garde, quote-unquote.
Yeah, and we started, and I began to realize more and more and more who I was.
Uh-huh.
I'm going after my roots. Why am I going to follow some other guys who I don't even know?
Uh-huh.
And I don't even like free jazz.
Oh, I actually do, but it's just another form of expression to me. You know, it's like everybody is allowed to express themselves. No one has to play it.
And if guys want to do it, fine. But I'm not doing that.
Right. And it's a good thing you don't have to.
Yeah. Yes.
So you mentioned doing the session work. How did you, because of your experience with the Crusaders, you were able to just walk into any place?
No.
And how did you get in?
Well, slowly.
Uh-huh.
Most of the record company guys, most of the producers, most of the guys who was at, like, Motown and that, they never would have called me because they knew I was a jazz musician.
Right.
Motown at one point wanted to sign the Jazz Crusaders.
Huh.
Or the Crusaders. And there was a lot of bickering. We had already created a relationship with Stewart Levine, and his partner was Master Taylor, and they had a record label known as Chisa.
Okay.
So we started doing business with them.
You went to Zaire, didn't you? The group went to Zaire? Quote Zaire?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you
That was And that was a Crusaders. That was for 70s something, right?
Right, right.
That was the rumble in the jungle. But I got into it. There was a singer. He was a songwriter. So he would come to my house. I had a piano and a reel-to-reel recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And it was two tracks. He sang on one track and I on the other track. Then what happened was he would then take his songs all around to all of the record companies, let people listen to his songs, so perhaps a recording artist would take his song and record them. But nobody recorded his songs. They would always ask him, who is that playing the piano? David Bryant. He was never a name singer. He was a songwriter singer. And he would pay me money to do that. And I was learning different styles of music. And he would say, well, play it more like this. Play it. And in other words, I was learning something from him also. He was actually doing like Motown style things or soul music things. And so I was learning how to support him as a singer. Eventually, I began working for a producer by the name of Mickey Stevenson. He was a Motown producer. And he got his own record label at one time, and he was married to a black female singer. Her first name was Kim. She was a prominent singer. I can't remember her
Kim
name.
Weston?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think his record company was called Venture.
Okay.
So I started doing record sessions for Mickey Stevenson, and then eventually the Motown guys began calling me. Not all of them, but quite a few of them. There's always a thing about a jazz musician. Don't call a jazz musician to make your record because he will screw it up.
Oh, no.
Well, this was a couple of guys back in the 60s used to tell me, You know, man, you really screwed up, Joe. You know, the guitar is the thing. Nobody wants a piano anymore. You made a big mistake.
Oh,
you should
goodness.
Have learned how to play the guitar.
Oh, my goodness.
I used to hear this all the time. I just look at these fools. And man, the piano has been here for 300 years. Shut up, get out of my face.
And you still play with other artists, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I still do it now. I moved from Los Angeles, so I don't do it as often as I did.
Right.
And they are not doing that many sessions anymore. There are so many recording studios that have shut down, and it is nothing of the way it used to be. Maybe I used to do 10 to 12 recording sessions a week, and now I may do 10 to 12 a year.
Wind up working with Randy Crawford?
She was signed to Warner Brothers Records, and her producer was Stuart Devine, and Stuart knew me from the Crusaders because he had produced a few records on the Crusaders.
Right.
So Randy knew of the Crusaders when she lived in Cincinnati. And she has always said that the type of band that she needed, she wanted a band just like the Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
They were bluesy, they were soulful, they were funky, and they had class. And that's what she wanted. So she asked, and I played on her record. I played on her third recording. The first one was 76, and I think I played on the next one in 77. She impressed me so much, I said, finally, this is a singer who I think could sing the melodies that I would write. Mm-hmm. I recognized a long time ago, I'm not a top 40 hit-making songwriter. I'm going to write some very unique music.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my music ought to come out of musicals.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked the Crusaders, I told them, I think it is time that we introduce a vocalist with the band now, and he's going to open everything up. Everyone agreed. And while sitting on a ski lift at Mammoth Mountain in California, where I had a home in the Sierras, it was a busy holiday, and I looked down below me, and I was on a beginner slope. I saw the beginners running into the other, and bam, boom, boom. And I said, man, that's a hell of a street life going on down there. When I got home, I began writing the melody. I got the melody to Will Jennings. And then the song, it just began to develop.
Very nice. And it was a hit.
Yes. And I'm still playing it today.
Excellent. Well, you probably can't leave anywhere without playing it.
I know.
But I know you did two together. You did Feeling Good, and then you did No Regrets.
And then we have another one.
A live one.
The live, yeah.
Yeah, that had to be fun.
Well, working with Randy is always exciting.
Layla Hathaway, how did you wind up working with her?
Well, when it was in the 90s, and Patrick Raines had become my manager in 88, 89. He also was David Sanborn's manager, and Al Jarreau's manager, Marcus Miller's manager. So we were all in that group. So Pat would put these shows together, and we would all join forces on a tour. The Japanese had a summer tour that was called Live Under the Sky. And Layla would participate in some of these things. I met her then.
Okay.
And then it came up that I was now going to Japan and working the Blue Notes there, which was 4 or 3 weeks at Blue Notes in Tokyo, Osaka, and Fukuoka. So Layla did one of those with me, and we located songs. And after the tour was finished, I suggested to Layla, man, we've got this stuff red hot right now. Why don't we just go into a recording studio and record it? And she agreed, and that's what we did. And that's how that album came about.
Excellent. How do you feel about working with singers? What does that do for you?
I like working with singers. I like it. It's fun, and I like to help them make their records. I went out with Eric Clapton. When you get singers, they have to make their live performances exactly like the record.
Mm-mm.
You have to play the same notes every night.
Ew.
I don't like that.
Oh. Have you had to do that a lot?
If I will go out with Diane Ross, yeah.
Oh, okay.
If I would go out with Smokey Robinson, yes. They want to hear, and even Donald Fagen with Steely Dan.
Yeah.
He wants me to learn, if I ever play with him, he wants me to imitate what somebody else either played on the piano or play exactly what I played on the piano.
Oh, my.
And he would say it to me. He wants to play exactly the way the record was played.
Mm.
That is against my principles of music. I don't want to ever repeat myself.
I'm sure that would be a violation for most musicians who are truly musicians, you know, artists.
Right, right. And you know what? And the thing is, I don't have any idea what I played.
Right. It's like, how long ago was that?
Playroom is a fun club filled with fans.
working with singers, it's an appealing thing to me. Yeah, making that record is one thing.
Uh-huh.
But having to play note after note after note.
Is there anything you want to let the listeners know that I haven't addressed?
I feel now, at this point of my life, I am playing better than ever. I believe that I am writing better than ever. I know that I have reached a critical stage with heart problems. I've had 2 heart attacks. I am on blood thinners. I'm walking on a fine line. I do feel very, 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 very strong. I want another 20 years. So I think I'm just on the verge of making some of the best music I have ever made. When you hear the Creole Joke Band, you're going to hear what I'm talking about. I think this is so much fun. So that's like, I'm praying, please, God, don't take me out of this game yet. I'm just getting started, man.
Well, you know, there's one thing I do want to ask you, and I try to ask everybody about this. Music and education. And you'd mentioned you have the artist in residence at
Texas Southern University.
Right. And I had also then asked you about the Catholic school and whether they had a music program. And I suspect you also, when you were younger, there was music in your school?
Of course, there was music in public schools.
Right. Exactly.
That's how I became so close and so tight with the Crusaders.
Right.
I don't know if schools, what was it, in the state of New York, somebody in New York made a statement in 1970s that music education is an unnecessary frill.
Mm.
Now, do you remember that?
No. And I'm sorry to hear that it happened in New York.
Yeah, and then it spread across the country. Well, that's the first thing they're going to cut is music.
Right.
Music and art.
Well, I guess your being at the university is your connection to music and education, and that's enough.
Yeah, and I just did the first year, and now we have a big band that performs.
Right.
And I'm creating a combo. Houston has a high school for the arts, and they have wonderful students who come out of there. But the younger kids, I really don't know what kind of music they are doing, you know. There's a problem here just in keeping the schools open.
Right.
This is a very heavy Republican state.
Sure.
And I don't think that they are that fond of teaching kids music. If they got to pay for it, they don't want to do it.
Right. So do you have any suggestions of what we could do with our children and music and introducing them?
Not really. I was trying to, at my old Catholic school, I was talking to the Cassio people about turning that school into a music school. When I mention it around town, everybody tells me that sounds like a lot of trouble. You know they already have the high school. I said, wait a minute, I think you guys don't understand what I'm saying. I am not talking about a school where you go to and get some credit, where you are working to move to the next grade. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about a music school.
Mm-hmm.
You have no goal there other to learn how to play music. You are not looking for a degree.
Right.
You're not looking for a diploma. So that's what I'm trying in this thing. And I had been speaking with the Casio company.
Right.
About doing, going in that school. But now I have to get the local support, first of all, and I have to explain to the local people exactly what I'm talking about. When I first mentioned it, they all think that I need a license from the state. I mean, or I'm trying to award diplomas. No, I just like a piano teacher lives over on the next block.
Right,
that
right.
Old school. But I would need to get support from the community. Who would support it? Well, Casio would, but there has to be some support coming from the community also.
Exactly.
Casio would be interested in doing it all around the U.S., but one community has got to do it first.
That's a good sign, just to know that if the communities actually got together and formed, that there would actually be a corporate supporter.
Right, and this is what I got to find. Oh, there's some people out there with grants.
Right.
But I don't want to get it into some political stuff where we're using taxpayers' money.
Right.
And I'm going to give diplomas from the state of Texas. I don't not want politicians in this other than they're saying, that's an excellent idea, and we will find you some grant money.
Right. That sounds wonderful. Well, Joe Sample, thank you so much for spending this time with Sugar in My Bowl. I'm really grateful that you were this generous with your time. And all the best of health. Thank you, Joe Sample.
All right, then.
And we'll keep an eye out for you in September when you visit the Blue Note.
Okay. All right, so I'll see you at the Blue Note.
Excellent. All right. Good night, Joe Sample.
All right. Okay. All right, take it easy. Goodbye.
Neither lost nor found. Hear the lonely sound of music in the night. Nights are always bright.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. That was a conversation that we had with Joe Sample last year in, I guess it was around June or so, that we broadcast this program originally. And unfortunately, Joe Sample was transitioned. He left us on September 12th. And as a matter of fact, he was interned this past Saturday. What you're listening to right now is Street Life, Randy Crawford on lead vocals in the Crusaders, the title track from a 1979 Blue Thumb Records release. Before that, we heard Third World Man, Steely Dan, from Gaucho. This is a 1984 MCA Records release. Before that, we heard Feeling Good, the title track, Randy Crawford, Joe Sample, PRA, PRA Records, 2007 release. Before that, we heard Freedom Sound, the Jazz Crusaders, the title track. That's a 1961 Hallmark Records release. Before that, we heard Never Had It So Good. That was from Lighthouse 68. It was a 1968 Pacific Jazz Records release. And coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. And once again, we do send our condolences to Yolanda, Joe Sample's life partner, and his son Nicholas, who was a member of the Creole Joe Band. He is a bassist. He's played with his father during other engagements as well. And I also send condolences to other members of the Sample family, of whom I am not aware. We will not be here next week, as Sugar in My Bowl will be back on Sunday, October 5th, with another program. And that program will be right before the fun drive starts. So stay tuned. La Nueva Alternativa is coming up next on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.